A typical summer morning in southern Wisconsin is rich with the sounds of mourning doves and cranes and many other familiar birds. But some of those songs are disappearing quickly. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
According to a recent report by the Audubon Society, common American bird species have declined dramatically during the past 40 years. The northern bobwhite is down 82%, the evening grosbeak down 78%, the northern pintail down 77%, and your chances of hearing a whippoorwill are less than half of what they would have been in 1967. Just 150 years ago, passenger pigeons were so plentiful that they blackened the sky. And within 60 years, they were extinct. Are some of today's abundant species also headed for oblivion? And if so, what can we do to save them? Our guest is UW-Madison wildlife ecologist Kevin Ellison.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks, Emily.
I'm kind of thinking that the job you have would be a combination of joy at getting to be out hearing and seeing the birds and depression if those statistics are to be believed. Tell me about the work you do and what brought you into that field.
Sure. Currently, I'm working as a postdoctoral research associate with Chris Ribbick at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she also works for the U.S. Geological Survey. And then I also work with David Sample from the Wisconsin DNR on a grassland bird project in the Mount Horeb area in south-central Wisconsin here. I originally got into birds as a kid growing up in northern Illinois. I was quite interested in the bird life around as well as the other wildlife, and then kind of let that passion die down as other things took over in my life as I grew older. But then during my undergraduate, I was drawn back into wildlife research, primarily through some courses I took at the University of Illinois, and then also a talk given by a professor down there. And after the talk, I had gone up to him and asked him, how does one get into work like this? And he replied, what are you doing this summer? And kind of the rest was history. I don't think I've ever had too many days in a row sleeping past dawn since then. But it's been an exciting way to do science and also kind of blend that love of the outdoors with work.
Is it even possible to characterize, to summarize the bird population of Wisconsin?
A lot of wildlife biology, we look at different scales, so kind of the coarse, you know, broad landscape level scale, and then as you look at finer different habitats, it's kind of a mosaic that's stitched together. So it is quite interesting, the bird life that is found in Wisconsin. I'm always amazed at going to new places and just the surprise. You never have the same day twice, I guess, is part of it. So it's pretty interesting seeing, and I mean, the unknown element of it is what you're going to find. I've always been quite interested in bird reproduction, and my first job was monitoring bird nests, so I got to kind of follow the days of their lives with the birds, seeing how young birds do in the nests, and then also different pairs trying to re-nest over time. So doing that type of work, you get a real quick appreciation for how hard these birds are working. I mean, if these were humans involved in what the birds are exposed to, we would be in a lot of therapy for
yeah,
a lot of
constant
things
that terror
happen.
For
yeah,
one
exactly.
Thing.
Yeah. So.
And what do you do? Let's say you get up; it's extremely early, and you're trying to follow the population trends of certain birds. How do you do that?
There's a lot of different techniques that are used for surveying birds, and I'll talk about a couple of those that were used in the Audubon report. But what we primarily do is try to map the locations of singing males in the grassland habitat that I work in. And what we're really looking for is simultaneous detections. And so those allow us to say for sure that there are, you know, X number of individuals. If we hear three birds singing at once, we know there's at least three males singing in that area. And it's kind of assumed that those are three territories of resident males that would then have a mate and a nesting attempt within those territories as well. So a lot of survey methods are based on that detection of singing males just because it's a conspicuous behavior that we can easily assess. And that's also why birds are kind of favored for this type of environmental assessment. I mean, if you were to look at surveying insects or something like that, it would be much harder and more intensive, whereas birds are very conspicuous and just one step up in the food chain. So you can assess, you know, ecosystem health by looking at what birds are there rather than having to go through the tedium of looking at insects. But combined with that, the survey technique, we also locate bird nests, and then we employ video systems to record the nests and activity at the nest, and then that will allow us to identify predators that are kind of enemies of the birds and kind of reducing their productivity as far as producing more birds. So that's one thing we're really interested in the grassland, is kind of restoring the grassland so that we have – there's still predators out there, but they're predators typical of that habitat type rather than things like raccoons or possums that we would normally find in a woodland.
So in the grassland, though, these nests are fairly well accessible to all kinds of predators, aren't
right.
they?
Pretty much we've found that anything that's larger than an egg will try and eat that egg. So things down to the scale of a meadow vole or a small mouse, and then all the way up to white-tailed deer are also taking nestlings out of nests. So it's something you might not expect, but again, that's why we need the video.
They're not just eating the eggs. I mean, deer actually eat small birds?
Yep. And so we've also had instances where a deer will take a nestling out of a nest, and then the next night, around the same time, another deer mouth comes and appears. I don't know if it's the same deer returning to the same spot, but must be an interesting source of protein and minerals for the deer. But
I assume you have to compare your data then to something from, you know, 40 years ago or whatever. If you have the when the Audubon Society releases figures about the bobwhite being down 82%, let's say.
Right.
I assume they have to have a controlled repeat of what was done
right.
years
right.
ago.
Right.
To make
For
that.
Their survey techniques, yep, they're combining two types of data. So they have the breeding bird survey data and then also the Christmas bird count data. And the Christmas bird count data go all the way back to 1900. And the breeding bird survey started in about the 60s, I think around 65. So what they've done in this Audubon report is combined those two census or survey techniques together using a bunch of statistical techniques that I won't go into. But anyhow, they restricted the Christmas bird count data to that same time span, so from 65 on. Based on the name, you can tell that they're taking place at different times of the year. So the breeding bird survey is a survey of singing males, like what I was describing that we do in our work. But it's a roadside survey that includes 53-minute stops 1/2 mile apart. And then experienced birders will be counting the birds that are seen and heard during those surveys. And those take place between late May and early July, usually starting half an hour before dawn. In contrast, the Christmas bird count is a one-day survey that quite a few people can take part in at one time. And the idea or concept that they're following there for surveying the birds is a group will be surveying a 15-mile diameter circle on a single day within 2 weeks of Christmas. So it's kind of an early winter survey. And so that kind of allows us to account for certain species that might be migratory as well. But you can see that even just in the two survey types that are used, we're getting a really coarse level look at what's going on with different species. And that's where the element of time really comes in. And that's what's really important about this data set, is that it's, you know, a 40-year span that we're able to look at kind of broad scale changes.
I would guess some of those would be hard to even to duplicate. I mean, if you're saying, well, in 1967 we had X number of birds, singing males in this grassy area, and in 2007 it's a mall.
Right, exactly. So that's one thing that the authors of this study have done is correct for a lot of these things, so the repeatability of where the locations are. And then they also take account for variants that might be introduced by changes in the observers as well. So some of these routes might have different observers. So when I say it's a bunch of mathematical corrections in there, it's quite a few. So it's an interesting report. It is available online, too, and I have some of the links here we can provide later on.
Yeah, we can put that on our website as well. I noticed that one of the websites that you had mentioned was with the Audubon Society, that they have a list of the top 20 common birds in decline. And I noticed it includes, besides the bobwhite and the grosbeak and so on, it includes some that we might not think of as very glamorous or exciting, like the sparrow or the grackle.
Right.
Do you find that people have, that it's harder to get people worked up about an endangered grackle than, say, over a tiger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I think it's an interesting dilemma that we're faced with, but you always have to keep things in perspective, how ecosystems are kind of a sum of the parts, but also kind of looking at some of the applied benefits that we derive from these species. So if you look at timber companies faced with a spruce budworm outbreak or something like that, perhaps birds would be a far better alternative to spraying a lot of pesticides to take care of those pests. Birds might not be able to take care of all of the worms during an outbreak, but certainly they would be an organic alternative, and they're providing a service that we don't really put a monetary value on.
As these habitats have changed over the past 40 years in particular, are there bird populations that are going way up just as these others are going way down?
It does seem that there are some increases in certain species. Again, the study tried to correct for a few of these things. Certain rare species a birder might be more prone to seek out. compared to a more common species.
Oh, look, there goes a seagull.
Yeah, exactly, when you hear something different. What this study does, though, is take the broadest approach. So, I mean, oftentimes we tend to think, you know, on the individual scale, you know, what you see is going to have much more precedence in your mind rather than some broad scale study that's pieced together then. So a lot of times we do see real local increases in certain species. But again, across the continent, it might not be a full spread occurring in the populations there.
Can you give us an overview, I guess, of Wisconsin birds right now in terms of what you see as the problem areas, the birds you'd most like to see cared for or brought back? Just some general sense about what we're seeing outside our windows.
Sure. Yeah, there's certain species that are really of quite a bit of concern in Wisconsin. Again, this list is the common birds in decline. So some people might have a knee-jerk response to this list and say, well, you know, these things are really common. I see them all the time. But that's the point of the study, is that these things that we take for granted as being really common are actually decreasing quite considerably. So species that are going from, say, 5 million individuals down to 2 million. For instance, the common grackle was estimated to be at 190 million individuals in the population back in the 60s, and now they're down to 73 million. So again, they're kind of taking the approach that if you have these widespread common species that are declining, then this might be a broad-scale thing to be concerned about. Some of the threatened species, there's a very focused work going on to restore their populations. And again, they're way, way smaller numbers in their populations, but we do have success stories. One that comes immediately to mind is the Kirtland's warbler. I don't know if you know this warbler species that has a really geographically restricted breeding range in central Michigan on the lower peninsula, and that there is a population establishing itself on the upper peninsula. But this species is restricted to breeding in successional jack pines. It used to be known as the jack pine warbler. It's so dependent on the jack pines. But they basically need like Christmas tree-sized jack pines to live in. And so one kind of broad-scale regional problem has been fire suppression, as well as just the process of succession going beyond the point where they have that size of tree available to them. So trees are growing to maturity, and then the birds don't have this disturbance regime that they used to have through natural fire and stuff like that to maintain their habitat. But at this point, the population has been growing to a point where we actually have some now breeding pairs confirmed in Wisconsin.
So, because of controlled burns?
Yes. One thing that did occur was a burn that got out of control, created far more habitat than they were expecting to make, which immediately didn't please many people. But the long-term effects are starting to show themselves now in the population, so it's recovering quite a bit.
The impression I have is things like the bald eagles and a lot of the animals that got a lot of the birds that got a lot of attention are right. Coming back, right?
Yeah, quite a few success stories out there, so it's not all doom and gloom. So it is good to kind of reinforce that we can have positive effects on the birds as well. And it is somewhat comforting to realize that that can happen. But again, I think that also makes this wide-scale decline in the common species all the more important.
What other birds are you watching sort of with worry?
Well, the Henslow sparrow is one species that's tentatively looking like a success story through the USDA Conservation Reserve Program, which created millions of acres of what we call surrogate grasslands. So these are not necessarily native grasslands, but they're grasses that are planted primarily to preserve soil from erosion and preserve water quality, with a really nice added benefit of creating a lot of grassland bird habitat instead of corn and soybeans. Been a really good program for a lot of grassland birds. It's created a lot of surrogate habitat for the Henslow sparrow, which is a real species of concern, and they're actually starting to see a nice spike in their numbers. That's one of the few species that's starting to do well. But one thing we are kind of tentatively concerned about is the big push towards ethanol, corn-based ethanol. Kind of the economics of farming kind of drives decisions for what's done with the land. And so some of this Conservation Reserve Program land is somewhat threatened by the high prices for corn right now. People might rather grow corn on that land rather than make a set price for 10 years on growing grass.
So there goes some of that grassland habitat and maybe a resurgence in crow populations.
Right, exactly. So that's certainly something that can happen with these habitat changes. As we convert habitat types, it disfavors some and favors others.
What happens in the North Woods, for example, in Wisconsin, where I hear, for example, that over the course of recent years, you know, birches are much less common than they used to be, again, because of forest succession.
Mm-hmm.
This land was logged off 100 years ago or more and
right.
spent the last century going through succession and changing.
Sure. And to take it to a broader scale, I mean, if we go a little bit further north with the boreal forest, you do see these kind of changes that are occurring. Global warming is kind of implicated in some of these things as well as the human activities of logging, mining, drilling, et cetera, causing changes. Forestry practices in some instances are kind of encouraging, you know, more monocultures of certain types of trees, like you're suggesting, when you lose the birch but still have the conifers present. So certainly that's going to affect what species are there. But it's interesting if we go back to the grassland bird example, for some species like the Henslow sparrow, it's more a matter of structure of what's out there. So these are European grasses that have been planted in this program, but yet the birds are able to adapt to it and do well in it. So it's not necessarily that it has to be, you know, restored back to this pristine state that it wasn't originally, and the birds can still do well.
When, let's say, a conservation group is targeting a certain bird or deciding that it's something that needs to be watched, is each bird equal in terms of its perceived value, and you just look at statistical changes? Or, you know, for example, let's say the spotted owl becomes mm-hmm. the thing that you can't have construction
right,
on a site
right.
where the spotted owl might be.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to choose which bird, which kind of sparrow, mm-hmm. which kind of, you know, whatever,
right.
how is that done?
A lot of it is kind of, it's weighted on the associated species as well. So in the spotted owl's case, it was a good indicator of old growth forest. And it's such a specialist. So a lot of times we're looking at specialist bird species that have specialized on a certain biome or habitat type. And then they can basically act as indicators of the quality of that habitat. So something like a spotted owl is going to be dependent on certain prey items as well as nesting requirements. And so all of those kind of parameters of its life history are encompassed in its success and presence there. So you can tell that you have a good, healthy, old-growth forest when you have the presence of those species. Also, the range size that they require. So a lot of times we're looking at kind of wider-ranging species as well. You can go from large species like raptors like that down to like the California gnatcatcher, which is a little 5-gram bird that has halted a lot of development in Southern California as well. But there, again, it's kind of a species that requires quite a bit of land and acted as an indicator of certain habitat types in that area.
Well, we'll look at some of these specific bird population declines and what's brought them on and what might reverse them when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, call 800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Kevin Ellison, who is filling us in regarding some of the alarming declines in populations of very, well, previously common birds in Wisconsin and giving us an idea of what is going on out there when we're seeing declines in the range of 70% to 80% over the last 40 years of some very common birds. I know your specialty is grassland birds, but I'm getting the idea that these are not just grassland birds we're talking about on the decline.
Right, yeah, these are species that are found in quite a variety of habitat types, which is also cause for alarm. Also, we're probably seeing kind of the impacts of human land use in a lot of different habitat types, and so this is culminating in lower counts of a lot of different bird species. I thought I could just go through kind of a summary of the list and mention some of these species. Again, this is the top 20 common species that are in really quite dramatic decline. So I would start with the grasslands that I'm most familiar with. There's four species on the list that are common to grasslands, and those are the bobwhite quail, the eastern meadowlark, the loggerhead shrike, the field sparrow, and the grasshopper sparrow. That's actually five, counting the bobwhite. But these species all seem to be heavily impacted by the loss of farmland and grassland as a whole.
And would you say the top enemy would be just more and more urban sprawl, more and more buildings, you know, or do you have some sense of if you had to rank the threats,
mm-hmm.
what the biggest threat is.
Sure. I mean, overall, we say habitat loss, but that also encompasses degradation. So, I mean, it's really clear for us to see like a mall parking lot juxtaposed with some prairie or natural-looking grassland. But still, there's just kind of a buffer of effects and impacts that are occurring around the disturbed area. So for a lot of birds, particularly those that migrate up to Wisconsin, one of the biggest detriments to their productivity or ability to produce more young to replace themselves is nest predation. That's one thing I never really got a feel for until I actually started doing nest-based work, that it's pretty typical for a lot of these songbird species to experience predation rates or failure rates of 30 to 70%, and usually on the higher end of that. So a lot of these species are looking at migrating up here from Central America or the Gulf states and then having about a two-month period to actually try and nest and raise eggs, hatch eggs and raise young, process that normally requires just about 24 to 30 days. So you can see that they'd be pretty hard-pressed just from time alone, even if they were in an ideal situation with no predators to kind of detract from their success. But we see a series of different processes occurring. So we have the habitat loss, just the physical loss of habitat, as well as the degradation due to either pollution, pesticides, as well as things that are occurring like, you know, subsidized populations of predators, say raccoons, for instance, that are able to live off of garbage from residential areas and stuff like that, kind of upsetting the balance of the system. So one thing that has been looked at is kind of the loss of certain top predators or species that require a lot of area. It's kind of a more dramatic example to think of something like mountain lions or coyotes to keep down populations of medium-sized predators that then once the kind of intact sensitive area is shrunk enough, then you lose these species that require more space. And then there's kind of a proliferation in the medium-sized predators that can then prey more on bird nests. So
coyotes, for example.
Yep. Coyotes will exclude foxes, and it just goes kind of down the food chain as far as which species can be kept in check, so to speak, by larger species.
Well, it kind of raises a problem that sounds hard to solve if you need a large area, unsettled area for the large predators, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, some kind of a large size cat
right.
or a wolf,
mm-hmm.
and to stop the medium-sized predators that do so well in
right.
those marginally settled areas, you know, raccoons and coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you solve a problem like that?
Right. I mean, basically it comes down to a lot of land use planning and then also habitat restoration, just to create areas intact enough that we're able to maintain kind of a steady system rather than one that's kind of in flux and that's harder for the birds to adapt to as well.
And do you find the same thing occurring, for example, with butterflies that's happening with birds? And it's just across the board decline in species?
Somewhat. I know certain insects are more specialized to, let's say, one individual plant type. And so they're aided more directly through, you know, propagation of the host plant that the butterfly is dependent upon. But yeah, I'd say overall, I mean, habitat impacts are probably one of the most pervasive effects on wildlife as a whole.
And the five grasslands birds that you mentioned, would you say that the problem is more or less the same for the five? Or does each one, let's say you take the bobwhite, is there some special situation just involving the bobwhite?
Yeah, with the bobwhite, there's kind of the added angle of it being a game bird species. So obviously it's going to be propagated for hunting. So there's been releases of captive bobwhites, and then also the hunting is kind of removing certain birds from the population. So the genetics might be a little more complex than looking at these more wild bird populations just because people are moving them around and then also taking them out of the populations. Also to look more continental-wide, forestry practices have affected the bobwhites really in the south with a lot of pine plantation impacts as well as agriculture. And then another southern-based thing is the invasion of fire ants. Fire ants will actually keep birds off of the nest by attacking the eggs or nestlings and eating them. So that's a problem across the southeast and starting to move into the west and more northerly. So those are kind of specific problems for the bobwhite. But again, they're also a species that will be preyed upon by things like foxes and cats. So they're kind of getting it from every angle as far as trying to breed successfully out there.
Where are the fire ants coming from all of a sudden? Is that yet another ecological disaster?
Somewhat. I'm not sure of the exact history on how they were introduced. I think it was probably through captive plant stock or something like that. But
they're moving north?
Fire somewhat, ants. Yeah. I would have to look into that to see where they're coming from and how far they've spread. I just know that they're a problem, like in Florida and the southeast.
And if we take something like global warming, how would that affect what's happening with the bobwhite?
With the bobwhite, I mean, it's certainly going to affect plants that are present to some extent, but the bobwhite's more of a generalist that I think would be able to handle a lot of that. This would be a perfect segue to the next group I was going to talk about, though, which is the birds of the boreal forest. So the boreal forest being more northerly is being impacted more heavily by global warming. And you can see those effects, I think, more directly when you think of a more northerly habitat type. So the species in the boreal forest are the evening grosbeak and boreal chickadee that are being impacted, probably due in some part to global warming, but also the timber harvest as well as mining and drilling. And then the other species of the boreal habitat type is the snow bunting, which is found in the boreal tundra areas, so more open areas. But these are species that appear to be affected by global warming type events as it dries out certain areas or affects the timing of certain insect emergencies that the birds would be dependent upon. So a lot of the global warming effects are certainly drier weather in certain areas that's affecting some of the species. The northern pintail is one of the duck species that's on the list, and it's really dependent on these prairie potholes, which are just shallows that are filled with water on prairies, and a lot of those are drying up due to climatic events. And the northern pintail is also one of the earliest breeders among the duck family, so to speak, and they're really going to be affected by kind of inclement weather that might be more unpredictable for them than it was in the past due to climate.
So is there a scenario that will say, well, we'll start making sure that there are potholes out there in the prairie for these birds?
There's been several organizations that have really tried to restore those habitats for the duck species in particular. Obviously, ducks as a favored game bird get a lot more money and conservation effort poured into them. So,
it's kind of ironic, yeah, isn't it?
Exactly. But again, hunters are great allies in a lot of conservation efforts because they are out there and they actually know these individual species and do start to, you know, have anecdotal accounts of the way it was when they were hunting with their grandfather versus when they go out to hunt certain species now. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic to have people that are taking some birds, but I think all too often people who don't hunt kind of assume that hunters are just blasting away Elmer Fudd style, but they're certainly much more selective than
Well, you hear the word harvest when it's applied to deer, I suppose,
sure.
To birds too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself getting emotionally attached to some of the birds? In other words, if part of your job is tracking the family lives, really, the breeding and the life expectancy of various birds, do you ever find it kind of tragic to watch?
I think it certainly gives you a new perspective for a lot of things. You certainly don't favor too many individuals once you see that nests are disappearing, you know, 70% of the time or something like that. But it is interesting to follow individuals. But that said, with our study, we're trying to identify predators. So sometimes you're almost rooting for predators too. I mean, basically, if you think about it quite objectively, everything needs to eat. And so it's kind of interesting to look at the system as a whole and think about how things are working together.
I was just thinking about those birds coming all the way up from the south.
Sure.
You know?
Very last day, they get nailed.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like that March of the Penguins documentary where you just sort of feel the labor that goes into trying.
It's certainly, I mean, it gives you real respect for what a lot of these animals are going through. Like I said, if humans were involved, they would be in therapy quite often. But one extreme example is the bobolink, the black and white bird of the grasslands that migrates all the way from Argentina and Bolivia all the way up to these temperate areas like Wisconsin in a lot of our fields. Very common bird in the fields, and they nest on the ground like all these grassland species. So obviously they're going to be heavily impacted by mowing hay and things like that. And so it's kind of sad to see a whole flock of birds that have migrated thousands of miles with no navigation equipment, made it here, set up a nest. You know, they're vigilant against predators and everything else, and then it's all mowed in one day. Just, I mean, the almighty dollar, but that's a sad fact of life that there's going to be a trade-off for trying to use the same piece of land for different purposes. But that is one thing that we've seen over time, too. If you talk about changes from the 60s to current era, farming has developed different techniques. And one of those pertaining to hay is the development of haylage. So they're able to put away wet hay, cut it much earlier when it has a higher protein content for the livestock. And obviously, when you mow earlier, that's going to impact more birds that are nesting on the ground out there.
So. Well, are there more accommodations now than there were 40 years ago for agriculture to bend a little bit for wildlife? I mean, the biggest example, of course, 40 years ago or so would have been the cessation of using DDT, which affected the eagle's ability to lay a hard-shelled egg.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a lot more kind of restraints probably placed on certain farming practices. But that said, we also seem to use what is devoted, the land that is devoted to farming more intensively than we used to because we're more efficient with our collection methods.
I saw something on one of the websites that that you had indicated had information. It had to do with a link with the lead that's a problem with the water and some problems with birds.
Yeah, a lot of waterfowl were impacted by lead poisoning. So if you think of like swans or other kind of bottom of lakes and ponds feeding on vegetation, these species would also pick up spent lead shot that was just, you know, missed a bird and dropped into the body of water. And so these birds are actually accumulating lead over time and then succumbing to lead poisoning. So that also during this time span of the bird decline, they've switched to steel-based shot instead of the lead-based shot. So that's something that we might see kind of a rebound from given enough time for that change from lead shot to the steel shot, which I think took place in the 90s.
Well, what about the link with fish and birds?
Yeah, certainly fish are interesting. Often birds are perceived as competitors for fish. Cormorant is a good example, and that's a species that seems to fluctuate highly in numbers. A lot of these fish-eating birds eat smaller fish than most fishermen would be interested in, but it is interesting to look at changes in certain types of fish and then also fish die-offs from certain phenomena such as pollution. That's certainly something that's been pointed to for the common tern, which is one of these species on the list that's in decline, a species that's dependent on fish and then is also relatively migratory. And if, you know, a population is migrating and they end up somewhere where they're hoping to cash in on some fish and there aren't any fish there that are in the size and type that they're able to digest, then they're just out of luck for arriving at that location. And I think that kind of does bring up an important point in the life cycle. A lot of these birds is migration. So if you think of just the awesome feat of a bird traveling 1,000 miles or so with no navigation equipment, these species also are dependent on certain stopover sites. And so this is something that really requires that broad-scale approach to piece together all of the stops along a migration route that a bird might be dependent upon, rather than just saying, you know, we have to protect the wintering area and the breeding area. There are also locations that are very critical to the birds through the migratory routes. So you can see how we might be able to protect, you know, focus on protecting certain areas in the south and the north, but miss out on certain areas in between that are important to the birds.
So as far as flying into Wisconsin, though, I mean, are there and these destinations, what are some of the major ones that seem to be still in danger that would affect the outcome for bird populations?
I keep returning to the grassland birds, but I'm trying to think of some in the woodland. The whippoorwill is one that's been affected by some probably pesticide use to keep down certain species in kind of timber stands. Trying to think what else would impact whippoorwills. Certainly fire suppression and more so with the spraying for gypsy moths control has been implicated by the Audubon Society in their decline. So a lot of these species are dependent on more kind of successional habitats that have been disturbed and then are continually disturbed. So they're used to like the medium-aged kind of regrowth. So the brushy stuff that a lot of people don't like to see. So a lot of people prefer either mature forests or things that are cut clear down. So that also brings up an interesting point too, is that what you'll see a lot of people do on their land is try to maintain several habitat types on their land, whereas from a bird perspective, it might be better to focus on just one habitat type and create a larger patch of that one habitat type rather than trying to replicate a small parkland or woodland habitat juxtaposed with a grassland or something like
but
that.
But I would gather these birds would have conflicting needs. Like yep. if I look at, you know, something like the Pheasant Branch Conservancy where there's been a lot of clearing of brush mm-hmm. and so on, I suppose that's great for some birds.
Right.
But not so good for some of the other ones that you mentioned that are dependent upon the brushier
stuff.
Right.
There are a lot of trade-offs in what we do in our habitat management.
It almost makes you think you should just leave it alone if you really want yeah. to create the best effect.
well, certainly like the species that are real specialists. So the grassland species I work on are called grassland obligate species. So they only nest in the grassland. And then we have a lot of hedgerows and wooded tree rows that we take out to maintain the grassland because it's kind of reverse fragmentation. It's trees moving into the grassland that we're concerned about. And so we're trying to maintain that balance. If you look at kind of historic maps, you can see how widespread grassland was at one time. And now if you subtract what's been put into agriculture and into kind of woods that have sprung up in the meantime, you can see more clearly that certain species of certain habitat guilds, we call them species that are dependent on a certain habitat type, need more help than others. So we do remove tree rows that are probably negatively impacting. When we remove them, we're negatively impacting species like the yellow warbler or song sparrow, but they're certainly more common and they have more alternative habitat types available to them because they're more generalist in what they use for nesting.
Well, it does get complicated, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
We're going to talk about some of the things that all of us can do to help with declining bird populations to reverse that trend when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, call 800-747-7444.
Over increasingly large areas of the United States, spring now comes unheralded by the return of the birds, and the early mornings are strongly silent where once they were filled with the beauty of birdsong. Those are the words of Rachel Carson in 1962 in Silent Spring. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Kevin Ellison. We're talking about the bird population in Wisconsin. Let's say that we all agree that it's bad to see these birds declining, that we want to do something about it. Let me give you three kind of typical Wisconsin residents, and if you can maybe point to some practical things that we could do. I live in a suburb of Madison, 4 acres, lots of land that's sort of a mess of different styles like you were talking about, mm-hmm. some prairie, some trees. Okay, so there's one. Mm-hmm. Sister-in-law on Sand Lake near Eagle River, mm-hmm. Hemlock Forest. Mm-hmm. And friends, Dairy Farm in Toma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always going to be complex to try and give a prescribed management plan for individual landowners, but I think some general things do crop up across different properties. One simple thing is just mowing. It's kind of a common land practice that we practice, mowing down grass or in farming situations, mowing of hay. The later you can mow in the spring or summer, the better generally because that, again, the element of time that the birds need to actually raise their young really comes into play here. And if you're able to put off mowing certain areas and let taller grass grow up, even if it's small patches sometimes, it's enough for some birds to actually nest in there and successfully pull off young before you mow. Another thing is even if you have to mow, you can if you have a larger expanse, you can begin to mow in the middle of the field and then mow outwards, which is kind of the reverse most people think of doing. But this, in theory, would at least give kind of fledgling-age birds or birds that are able to hop a little bit a chance to get away from the mower rather than being concentrated into the center of the field where they're then ultimately going to get hit by the mower. So that's one kind of grass-based solution. Again, a lot of these different property types are going to be really kind of site-specific for, or even species-specific if you want to have a target species that you want to help out. In the hemlock forest, you tend to think more about warbler species nesting in trees and stuff like that. So management practices would be more probably hands-off in certain areas, or maybe even for if you have species that are dependent on regeneration, maybe some type of disturbance like a controlled burn or something like that, depending on the habitats surrounding that area as well. You always want to take into consideration the surrounding habitats, so you're not kind of just creating your lone island of trees and then you're surrounded by all grass or something like that. So it's good, I guess, to think more at that broader scale, even beyond your own particular property, but incorporate it with your neighbors and stuff like that, to just to have a more holistic plan for birds that require more area generally than our 3-acre or 1-acre parcels.
And what about water management?
Water management, particularly, I mean, what I generally think of is for like big water treatment areas and stuff like that, where they're able to do drawdowns and raising levels of water in different areas. It's more complex than you would imagine, but as you study this stuff, certain species are really dependent on different depths of water. And so it becomes complex. Again, you're always kind of picking and choosing which species you're trying to favor.
In a marsh and a pond,
right,
kind of thing.
Exactly. And so you have these different, you know, wading birds and then birds that are dabblers and then diving birds. So it's quite complex, but that's why we have all these professional land managers to give us the current best concept on how to solve those problems.
I would suppose that runoff would be an issue too. I mean, agricultural mm-hmm. runoff, the way it affects, say, an algae bloom in a lake, mm-hmm. what impact would that have on bird species?
Sure. I mean, certainly there you can look at from kind of a mild case scenario to a worst case scenario, and I guess starting with the worst would be that there could be a fish die-off or something like that in a body of water if enough pollution were introduced to the system. It can temporarily remove enough oxygen from the system through an algal bloom that fish might die off, and then some sensitive species might move on from the area, or maybe that they only have enough energy to make it to that area and then they will suffer some real consequences of not having enough food available to them.
What about home bird feeders? I mean, I've got mm-hmm. my Baltimore Oriole feeder, the right. hummingbird feeders, you know, mm-hmm. things for the finches and all kinds of feeders. Is there ever a situation where you can maybe unsettle a population by creating feeders that are there where it sort of disrupts what would be happening with migration or causes a dependency that maybe isn't such a good thing?
More what I tend to think of is you might tend to favor certain species. I tend to be more concerned about invasive species or introduced species like the English house sparrow and the European starling are two kind of common species around urban areas that really thrive off of certain types of bird seed that some people may or may not want to have available in their feeders. I tend to favor the black seeds. So if you use like Niger seed for your goldfinches, that's a type of if you use a tube feeder with the Niger seed, you'll just get those nice goldfinches and you'll get house finches sampling it from time to time. And also some migrants will sample that Niger seed, which is incidentally not a native seed, but it's heat treated so that none of it can germinate. So again, we're conscious of problems that we might cause through our activities. But that's one type of kind of species-specific feeding that you can focus on. Also, if you use focus more on the black sunflower seed or safflower seed, that alone is favored by cardinals, which are another feeder favorite. But I think for the most part, we tend to think of our feeders as being like huge caches of food for these wild species. But I think the net effect is probably pretty minimal on some of the resident species. Again, certain storms, you know, might come through and that feeder might save the life of one or two birds, but it's certainly not going to have a wide scale effect on those species. But again, things like the house sparrow, when people get certain bird feeds that are more millet-based, that the sparrows are just kind of rampaging through. I'm sure that kind of gives them a leg up.
We seem to have a lot of mourning doves. What's your verdict on them?
Yeah, they're a common species that seems to be doing quite well in certain areas, but they are a game bird in certain states too, so their population can be in flux. They're kind of unique in that because they're able to use seeds to feed their young. They basically produce what's called a pigeon milk or a crop milk, which is digested seed in their crop, and then they're able to regurgitate that to their young. They actually breed from, weather permitting, basically, say, early March through to sometimes September, October. So you can see that they have a lot more time available for them to breed and produce a lot more young than some of these migratory species or even our resident songbirds that are highly dependent on insects for their young. Most birds, even sparrows that we might think of as seed eaters, feed their young insects because of the higher protein content, which allows their young to grow as fast as possible to get them out of the nest so they aren't as susceptible to predation.
How much has the global warming affected the actual movement, the migration of birds? Are they sticking around longer in the fall and coming back earlier in the spring in Wisconsin?
I think certainly that could be occurring. What we've seen is more effects in the winter than in the summer. So, I mean, winter's been on average warmer compared historically with other past winters than our summers getting hotter, relatively hotter. So I think certainly some of these migratory species are probably affected to some extent. And then also the winter residents, certain species seem to be ranging further north now because they aren't restricted by the harsh winters as they once were. So things that would be either affected by snow cover or even just purely temperature are able to stay further north than they would have historically when it was colder.
Does it work the other way too? I know recently there was a sort of blossoming of Canadian owls down in Wisconsin because there was some agent of displacement in Canada.
Sure. There's a lot of work that goes into looking at these cycles of when owls and raptors move. They kind of have these big mass exodus from certain areas and then incursions into other areas. And it seems largely driven by cyclical rodent populations. So certain rodent species are really productive in certain years and then not as much in other years. And so these raptors are basically tracking these their prey populations. And so to look at how complex that system is, I mean, we're unable to identify, you know, any certain prey species or that drives some of these cycles. And so sure that, you know, whatever the birds are using to track these prey may be affected by climatic effects that we're ultimately having some impact on.
What about woodpeckers? It seemed to me that I used to, as a child here in Madison, see more in the way of red-headed woodpeckers, pileated woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. Now it's pretty much just the downies and woodpeckers.
Yeah, the pileated woodpeckers have a real requirement for large expanses, larger expanses of woodland. So that's probably an effect of kind of suburban sprawl and development as well. So they need more mature trees and more vast areas to range across for all of their habitat needs. And the red-headed woodpecker is one of these species that's really dependent on kind of the juxtaposition of open fields, fields with shorter grass, so pastures with mature oak trees. And so what's happened in a lot of instances is either land has been cleared for some other use, or the land that does have that oak tree kind of pasture interface, the understory has grown up so much that they don't have that available kind of savanna-like habitat available for them. And that's primarily driven by their foraging behavior. They like to perch and then come down and get insects off the open grass and then go back into the trees, which they obviously use for nesting.
Well, if we go back to the beginning of this hour and look again at some of those statistics, those really startling statistics that in the past 40 years, the northern bobwhite is down 82%, the evening grosbeak down 78%, northern pintail down 77%. We have, I guess, a variety of habitats represented there. Whippoorwills down more than 50%. What do you see as the prognosis if we take a population count 5 or 10 years from now? Is this likely to reverse through some human intervention, or how is it looking?
Yeah, I think it's going to really vary probably on habitat types, just based on our emphasis on conserving or restoring certain habitat types. And things like the switchover from lead-based shot to steel shot, we might see a rebound in some of these duck and water bird populations just based on something like that, just through that improvement in the habitat type. I think probably just more people becoming aware of birds and their kind of role in our lives, even if it's not a direct effect every day. Just the fact that birds are important environmental indicators, agents of insect control, and then also just for our enjoyment and entertainment. I mean, birding itself is a $1 billion enterprise. So birds are worth preserving. So I think we'll probably tend to appreciate them more and more. And hopefully more restoration efforts, we'll start to see more success stories with these species rather than the wide scale declines that we're looking at.
So if you had political power and a lot of money, what would you do here in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a loaded question. It's hard to say. I mean, it'd be interesting to try and, I guess, have control over what land is used for what. But ultimately, that's not going to work.
But if, for example, you could purchase as a sort of a conserved area, or, you know, if you could get land, would you target grasslands? Would you target forests? Would you kind of have, I mean, do you have some?
It's a real dilemma that we're left with in Wisconsin because we're at kind of the eastern edge of the prairie and then also the southern edge of the pine forest. So it's a blessing and a problem, actually a conundrum in that we have so many different habitat types, but yet we're trying to take care of them all at the same time. And so obviously I think coordination would be one thing to really focus on, just kind of developing a game plan for preserving different species and different habitat types. And there are some organizations that are really working at that, the state DNR as well as the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative are working on coordinating efforts to restore habitat types. And so one function that the National Bird Conservation Initiative has worked on is identifying important bird areas. And so in Wisconsin, it's Crex Meadows has been identified as one of the most important areas in the state. And so I think it's probably a good idea to emulate a model like that where we're actually identifying gaps in our kind of land use plan and then preserve those areas and probably add on to them in area just to have buffers against more potential impacts. I think another thing to be wary of is kind of the unforeseeable future. So certainly we've had a lot of different types of diseases like West Nile virus and things like that come about that could really affect certain bird populations as well as climatic changes. So I think it's good to keep an eye open to the future, things that we might not expect to happen, and plan for those in ways that we could mitigate the impact of things that would come about. So buffers against certain disturbance types making it into our preserve or core areas that we want to preserve.
The best buffer may be having a big as possible population of these birds mm-hmm. so that they can take the occasional setback. Mm-hmm. Our guest has been Kevin Ellison this hour. And, well, we're rooting for you and the birds.
Thank you.
And we'll have links to some of the websites that you had mentioned
sure.
on our University of the Year Wisconsin Public Radio website.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and thanks for joining us. Hope you'll be with us for the next hour of University of the Air.